Good evening, everyone. Nice to see some of you for the second time today, others for the first time. Welcome to season, what are we? Four? Season four of People the Book. With, I don't know, the packet says four. So. I don't know, the thing says four. Whatever the packet says. What? This is not Tanakh B'Shana, this is People the Book. Welcome back to People the Book. New people, new places, new works. Just by a show of hands, who has taken this course in the past? I hope everyone. A couple new people. All right, very nice. So for those who have taken the past know the general structure of how it works. This year, like last year, there are four sections. Each section will have three presentations on it. And we'll have a rotation of three wonderful speakers and one B-list speaker. Come on. Four fantastic speakers. And each week there'll be handouts, and hopefully by the end you'll really make you'll have acquired the personalities that we'll study about. Each personality is a little bit different also. Some will be a little bit more inside, some when there's more historical, biographical information about them, we'll do more outside. So each week will be a little bit different, and each presenter is a little bit different. Like in the back is Rabbi Kasorla. Those who have taken the past, Rabbi Kasorla is one of the most energetic speakers we have. So he's already, I think that's caffeine. He's caffeinating up for 3 weeks from now when he teaches. But hopefully you'll get both exposed to some wonderful speakers, some wonderful topics, and some wonderful presenters as well. Let's jump right in. Section number one that we're discussing this year is Sfardim of the Book. I don't know why we chose the Radbaz first. I'm guessing because I emailed Rabbi Kasorla and I said, Rabbi Kasorla, can you give me a list of three Sfardim? And he gave me this list. But really, in many ways, the Radbaz is a culmination of many of the other personalities that we've spoken about, and a very important personality because of where he stood in Jewish history. And that is what we will talk about. So for example, in the past, we've discussed people like the Rambam, who lived in 12th century. We studied Rav Avadia Yosef. That was 2 years ago. Rabbi Kasorla, I think, did like a three-part series on him and wanted to keep going. We had to stop him, right? But we did Rav Avadia Yosef, which of course was in the 20th century. And we didn't study many Sephardi personalities in between. The Radbaz is fascinating because he sits pretty much smack in the middle, both historically and from just a scholarly perspective, in between the Rambam and Rav Avadia, serves as the transition point, I'll say in many ways, between the two of them, and that is why we're discussing him tonight. The Radbaz is a fascinating personality, but here's the caveat. Much of what we know about him is not from history books. So for example, when you give a class about Rav Avadia Yosef, you have a tremendous amount of material to draw from. The Radbaz, Rav Dovin Ibn Zibra, oops, we're not supposed to be on that, right? Who we're going to be discussing tonight, there's not a tremendous amount of biographical information about him. So for example, if you were to go to the Encyclopedia Judaica and look up the Radbaz, you will still be looking. And the reason why I know that is because this morning I went to the Encyclopedia Judaica and that's why the class started 5 minutes late. Now, it's not even in there. He doesn't even exist in there. If you go online and you do just a elementary search for him, you will find very limited information about him. Okay? What we know about him, I will share with you. But most of what we know about the Radbaz is from his writings. Okay? Now that is a tremendous advantage, and that is a tremendous disadvantage. It's an advantage because were you to now spend the rest of your life learning the breadth and width of his scholarly writings, you would know a tremendous amount of Jewish history from that time period. The challenge is that in order to understand about him, you really have to dive into his works. And when you study his works, you learn a lot about him and you learn a lot about the time period that he's writing in. So as I said in the introduction, some of the classes will be more inside, some of them will be less inside. Tonight we're going to do more inside than we normally would, simply because I want to give you a taste of major writings of the Radbaz, and you can really only do that by studying some of it inside. Obviously, as I always promise, I'll limit the amount we read inside. I'll translate everything. You don't have to look inside if that's daunting for you. But I want to give you a taste of his writings because that is really where you learn about him. You're not going to learn about him in an art scroll book. You're not going to learn about him from Google, and you're not going to learn about him from the Encyclopedia Judaica. You're going to learn about him through his writings, through analyzing his writings. And when you analyze his writings, you find out a tremendous amount about him. Okay? Any questions before we go forward? Yeah? I meant to put in circa. According to many people, he lived to a very long age. Now, I don't believe he lived this long, but this is the years that are generally given, give or take. Okay? The exact year is less important than the time period. Okay? What do we know major is happening during that time period? What happens during the 16th century? So we know the Inquisitions, right? 1492, we know the Jews are expelled from Spain. What else do we know happens in the 16th century? No? What else do we know? Major, major event. Think Jewish. What's happening in the Jewish world in the 16th century? The most important Jewish book maybe ever written. The Shulchan Aruch is being written. Okay, in the middle of the 16th century. Who's writing the Shulchan Aruch? Yosef Karo. Where's Yosef Karo writing from? From Tzvad. And that's going to be important as we discuss the Radbaz. Let's start from the beginning. Who is the Radbaz? Okay? So the Radbaz was actually exiled from Spain. And again, that's all going to... I'm sharing a lot of the information I share is not insignificant. It is significant, and I'll explain a little bit. Traveled from Spain to Morocco, where he ends up in Fez, ultimately to Israel, spends a very short period of time in Israel, and then he arrives in Egypt in the year 1513. 1513 puts him approximately 300 years after the Rambam. Okay, the Rambam, of course, lives from, depending on who you ask, from around 1135 to 1204. Okay, the Rambam, obviously, for the what we'll call Sephardi world, and even for the Ashkenazi world, was the main guy. He was the main player. From the Rambam to the Radbaz basically, in many ways, and that's what we'll discuss tonight, takes over that mantle from the Rambam. The Radbaz is a massive Talmud Chacham. When the Radbaz arrives in Egypt, he's almost universally accepted as the chief rabbi of Cairo. Now, he's accepted as the chief rabbi of Cairo for a few reasons. Number one is he is a massive Talmud Chacham. I mean, his works are, we'll get to this a little later. He wrote thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of responsa. Incredibly impressive. More notably, however, is that he wasn't just a scholar. The Radbaz was a real community person, right? In other words, he wasn't just publishing, but he was, for example, I put on there, he's in charge of the charities, he's representing Judaism to other religions. He really is, in every way, shape, and form, he is the chief rabbi. Are people cold? Well, I am, and I'm in charge, so. It's a little cold, right? I said this morning already, but I was just in New York. And you ain't seen cold until you come back from New York. I still haven't thawed out from that. Okay? So the Radbaz, in every sense of the imagination, is the chief rabbi. Chief rabbi means he's not just getting random halachic questions, but he's getting community questions. In other words, things that are happening in the community are coming to him. And again, that's what makes his responses so fascinating, because it really gives you a sense of the pulse of what's going on in the community. It's the equivalent. People ask Rabbi Goldberg this all the time. When are you going to write a memoir, a tell-all of what goes on in Boca Raton Synagogue? So the answer is the day before he retires, right? So when he writes that eventually, right? Because that's when he can say everything about people, that he, right? So when he eventually writes that, it isn't just people aren't going to read it because they're interested in Rabbi Goldberg's Psak Halacha on X, Y, and Z. They're going to read it because in 200 years, sociologists are going to say, what was Jewish life like in Boca Raton in the year 2015? And what are they going to go to? They're going to go to Rabbi Goldberg's memoirs. And they're going to say, oh, people are asking questions about the following issues. people were bothered by this issue, they weren't bothered by that issue, and they're going to learn a lot about what life was like in Boca Raton just by reading his responsa. It's no different than if you read a book about John Adams and you study the letters that he and his wife wrote between each other. So the reason why David McCullough calls from those letters is not because we're voyeurs and we want to peek in on their love life. No, you use their letters to extrapolate information about the time. That's exactly what we are essentially going to do about the Radbaz. The other interesting point about the Radbaz, and this is a very important point in trying to understand him, is that he was phenomenally wealthy. The Radbaz was independently wealthy and very wealthy at that, which means, right? Wealthy rabbi means what? Freedom and autonomy. It means that when you don't like what he says, and you say, Rabbi, I'm going to fire you, you know what his response is? Nah, 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 boo, boo, right? Try to get rid of me. So essentially, that was the Radbaz. The Radbaz had a tremendous amount of autonomy. He was not confined, like other rabbis have been throughout Jewish history, by politics in the community. And that really allowed him, in many ways, to be above politics, to be above the fray. And that's one of the things we'll talk about as we explore his writings, is you'll see that in many ways, the Radbaz, instead of getting entrenched in the politics, spent his life trying to rise above the politics and bring people together, as opposed to being a divisive personality.
Do we know what he was wealthy from?
I don't know, Rabbi Kasorla, what was he wealthy from? We don't know. We don't know a tremendous amount about him. What we know, he threw in lines in tshuvas that you extrapolate from. But I don't know what he was wealthy from. Because I think for many people, his writings speak for themselves. Right? In other words, you learn about him by writing. You're saying, why isn't there an art scroll book about him? I don't know. That's why we're studying him tonight. If you could read the art scroll book, you wouldn't have had to sign up for the class. Okay. It's more about the biography. Famous students. He had two very famous students. One is the Ari HaKadosh. Okay, the Ari, of course, is going to find his way to where? To Tzfat, the founder of Lurianic mysticism. Okay, and we'll see that Kabbalah for the Radbaz actually plays a prominent role in much of what he's going to write. A lot of his writings are very Kabbalistic in nature. For example, one of his works, which I was going to get to later, but now that you mention it. So one of his works is a gorgeous, I understood maybe a word of it. I'm sure Rabbi Kasorla could understand more of it. But it's a gorgeous poem about Kabbalah and the nature of Kabbalah. But he was very Kabbalistic in many ways in nature. That is an interesting combination. The halachic person and the Kabbalistic person. And one of the tshuvas that we're going to see tonight is going to explore how those two interact. And what happens when there are contradictions between the two of them. How much is Kabbalah employed in the writing of halacha? Okay? So one of his students is the Ari HaKadosh. The other one is someone you probably have not heard of as much, which is Rabbi Bezalel Ashkenazi, the author of the Shita Mekubetzet. Has anyone here heard of the Shita Mekubetzet? Shita Mekubetzet, a few people. Shita Mekubetzet, also Egypt, came from Israel to Egypt because of extreme poverty. Israel at the time was a very impoverished country. And so he couldn't get a job in Egypt, in Israel, so he came down south, studied with the Radbaz. He ultimately became the chief rabbi of, it wasn't Cairo, a different Egyptian town. Okay? He wrote a sefer called the Shita Mekubetzet, which is essentially a compilation of different Rishonim, different early commentaries on the Gemara. So for example, if you were to open up a Gemara Bava Kama, and you were to want to learn Bava Kama, so one of the books that you would have by your side is the Shita Mekubetzet. Why would you have the Shita Mekubetzet? Primarily because he's preserving works of many other people. And that's supposed to be Rabbeinu, not Kabbeinu. Okay? He's preserving many other works. It is a phenomenally important work. You'll find it if you go into any Beit Midrash now around the world and you look on the shelves, you will see there Shita Mekubetzet. One interesting tidbit about the Shita Mekubetzet is what we'll call the Nagid controversy. Essentially what happened was when the Shita Mekubetzet, when Rabbi Bezalel Ashkenazi comes to Egypt, So because of his scholarship, he is very well regarded. Okay? And as usually happens, Judaism doesn't always work in the same way a rabbi here would work, where you're officially appointed. Right? A lot of times, the way a rabbi would be hired, or the way a rabbi would achieve his position, is simply by rising through the ranks. And eventually your peers would recognize you as the preeminent scholar of your day, and that kind of became your title. So for example, when did we ever appoint Rav Moshe Feinstein as the posek of our generation? Right? When was there ever a vote? Did the Moetzet get together and ever just... No, the answer is, at a certain point in scholarship, in fear of heaven, right, remote people started coming to Rav Moshe. And they liked what Rav Moshe had to say, so they started coming to Rav Moshe some more. And they still liked, right, and they kept on coming. Eventually, he became almost universally accepted as the posek of the generation, right? When did we ever decide that Rav Soloveitchik was going to be our calling card of a rabbi? The answer is never. It just kind of happened. These things happen organically more often than anything else. So that's what happens to the Shita Mekubetzet. He comes to Egypt, and organically, he becomes a major player. Okay? The, what I'll call Egyptian officials, or the Turkish officials at the time, they appoint someone else to the position of the Nagid. Nagid was kind of like the elder statesman of the community. And the Shita Mekubetzet, Rabbi Tzal Ashkenazi, comes to the Nagid, and he wants to, you know, you come, you meet, you're going to shake hands, you're going to break bread with each other, have a l'chaim together, and then you're going to have a good working relationship. And when Rabbi Tzal Ashkenazi comes to this newly appointed Nagid, the Nagid essentially says, you think you're hot stuff? Well, look whose presence you're in right now. You're in my presence, and you have to treat me with respect, and you have to treat me with reverence. And there was a tremendous amount of haughtiness, right? So Shita Mekubetzet left that meeting very disturbed, and essentially that ended that concept of the Nagid. Because the Shita Mekubetzet went back to his people and basically said, we're not recognizing him as an authority in our community because he's arrogant, because he won't recognize me. Now, to be clear, the Shita Mekubetzet wasn't saying that arrogantly. Right? For example, if I were to go to Rav Schechter now, well, Rav Schechter is a bad example because he's exceedingly humble. But if you were to go to Rav Moshe Feinstein, let's say, and you were to insult Rav Moshe Feinstein to his face, so Moshe Feinstein might say, right, you have insulted me, but I don't care about me. What do I care about? The Torah that I represent. In other words, we believe that there has to be a certain respect and reverence for Torah scholars, not because they command it, but because the Torah that they know commands it. And so when the Rabbi Tzal Ashkenazi sees that this newly appointed Nagid won't show him the respect, do you know what he does? Doesn't pass the smell test, he says. This guy's not the real deal. He's not the type of person we want in charge of us. Okay, and that essentially caused the breakdown of that concept called the Nagid, of that position called the Nagid. Let's come back to the Radbaz. The Radbaz had to fight against two major issues. And they're both similar, but it's important to recognize the two of them. Number one is, as Jews from Israel descended to Egypt, what you essentially had is the following. You had an Egyptian community on the one hand, which was heavily steeped in whose halacha? In the Rambam's halacha, right? Generations, centuries of following a certain way of life. All of a sudden, this group of Israelis come down with an entirely different set of customs. And there's a clash between the two of them. Okay? We don't appreciate that in America as much because our customs have been so neutered, basically. Right? Diluted is probably a cleaner word, right? But diluted from basically 1,000 years of exile. But if you go to a Sephardi minyan, for example, right? Any Sephardim in the room? No. Sephardim are much more passionate about their customs than Ashkenazim are. That's because Sephardim were much more insular throughout history than Ashkenazim were. Sephardim weren't exposed to the exile as much as we were. Okay? All of a sudden, you put basically Sephardim from one place and Sephardim from another place in the same room, and you say, now we have to do one approach to Judaism. You know what's going to happen? It's called our Sephardi Minyan. No, basically, right? You're going to have very different people, very passionate about their customs, each one feeling very strongly that they should be the correct perspective, right? Now, what happens in our Sephardi Minyan when such a decision needs to be made, right? We hire someone so that Goldberg and I don't have to take the brunt of it, basically, right? We hire a Sephardi rabbi. And the Sephardi rabbi, his main role, amongst all of his other wonderful qualities, and we love Rabbi Shabtai, but his main role is that when one guy says, in Morocco, we did it this way. Although Moroccans aren't Sephardi. Right? Whatever. In Morocco, we did this. In Iran, we did this. Rabbi Shabtai, we're doing this in Armenian. Right? That's what his role. That's essentially exactly what the Radbaz had to do in Egypt. Because he had a very insular community. Egyptian community was relatively insular. All of a sudden, these Israeli Jews are coming down saying, that's not how we do things in Israel. This is how we want to do things now. And so the Radbaz had to kind of walk this tightrope, a very delicate tightrope, between on the one hand, being true to the Egyptian culture and Egyptian customs, and on the other hand, allowing the Israelis to come in, feeling that they have a place in Egyptian society as all, and making sure everyone coexists harmoniously. That exact same problem manifests itself with Spanish Jewry. Spanish Jews are kicked out in 1492. Many of them end up in Egypt. What happens again when you have Egyptian Jews who've been doing things for hundreds of years one way, and you have Spanish Jews who've been doing things for hundreds of years another way? You have the exact same problem. You have a conflict of what the correct custom should be. And so we'll see examples of where the Radbaz had to basically chime in. And he had to say, although here it was done one way, and here it was done another way, in our community, it's going to be done the following way. Now that takes a tremendous amount of tact, but it also requires you to not be beholden to the community who's paying you. Right? Sometimes it means going against what the Egyptian community has been doing. The Radbaz can do that because he didn't really care. Yeah. I don't know.
I thought that Egyptian Jews came from Spain, Portugal.
Well, let's put it this way. We know that the Rambam lived in Egypt.
But he was originally from Spain.
Well, sorry. So Jews have been there. The Gemara talks, a very famous case, but an interesting case, where the Gemara describes what Jewish life was like in Alexandria. And the Gemara says, you want to know how many Jews lived in Alexandria, that when they used to have minyan, right? Anyone remember here last year when Rabbi Sachs was here? It was actually a year ago today. Facebook reminded me that he was meeting in the office. So this Shabbos, a year ago today. Thank God for Facebook, right? So when Rabbi Sachs was here, so we had seats all the way back. If you were sitting in the back, you could not hear a word he was saying, right? What were you trying to do? So maybe read lips, if your eyesight's good enough. At best, when you heard everyone else laughing, you know what you were going to do? You were going to start laughing also, right? So that's what happened in Alexandria in the time of the Gemara. The minyan used to go back so far that you couldn't hear the Shliach Tzibur, you couldn't hear the Chazan. So what they did is they had a flag. And when it came time to say Amen, they would raise the flag. And that's how everyone knew to say Amen. That's how many Jews we were talking about. So there have been Jews going back all the way to the time of the Gemara. We know that, again, I'm sure a historian could give you more information, but we know definitively there were many Jews there in the time of the Rambam. And again, we know that there's a very large Jewish community there in the time of the Radbaz. Okay? The Radbaz is one of the examples when you talk about the prohibition of returning to Egypt. So the Rambam and the Radbaz are the two examples you refer to. And one of the cases is that in both of their times, you know that there were large, vibrant Jewish communities existing in Egypt. How can there be a biblical prohibition of going back to Egypt? Okay? That is essentially what the Radbaz is battling against. He's battling against this need to maintain a cohesive community, despite the fact that you have many different people coming from many different places. Okay? Major writings. His Meder writings are essentially the Tshuvos HaRadbaz, which are 8 volumes of over 3,000 responsa. That is a lot. And this is small print, as you'll see in a second. Right? We're not talking, you know, double-spaced. My wife's in graduate school. So she has to fill, it's like ridiculous. She has to fill a certain number of pages for papers. So it's like, you know, like 40 font, triple spaced. It's ludicrous, right? Like, I feel like I'm in, right? But this isn't the Radbaz. When we're talking about like 8 volumes, we're talking about a tremendous amount of literature. And again, that's where we know most of the information. Some of the Rambam's Mishnah Torah, most notably when there isn't the comments of the Magen Mishnah, so the Radbaz chimed in and wrote a gloss on the side of the Rambam's Mishnah Torah as well. And then you have his lesser known works, many of which I don't know about at all, but I quoted them for you here just so you would know them. The Keter Malchut, that's what I was telling you about all beforehand, which was a Kabbalistic poem. But as you see, at least the top 3 are all about Kabbalah and very Kabbalistic in nature. Okay? That is the Radbaz. Why are his responses so important? As we discussed earlier, his responses are important not just from their halachic viewpoint. And if you Google Radbaz, you won't see biographical information. You will see where it has been cited in countless other works. Okay? But not only for their halachic perspective, but also for their historical significance. Let's jump right in. And for this, you will need your supplemental packet. And again, no one should be scared by it. And you don't even need to look inside. You could follow along without looking inside at all. We are going to see some more in depth, some I'll read 2 lines. Some I won't read at all, I'll tell you outside. We are going to look at 6 responsa from the Radbaz, each one with a different purpose. I didn't just like randomly choose them. Each one I want to glean a different, what I think is significant point about him from. First tshuva is a tshuva about the Rambam. Okay? The Rambam writes the following. In the time of the Rambam, and anyone chime in on this one if this happens in your show. Okay? What used to happen in Egyptian Jewry in the 12th century is that while the Chazan was doing Chazarat HaShatz, when he would do the repetition of Shemoneh Esrei, so everyone would turn to their neighbor and do what? Start talking. Right? And anyone happen in their shul? Right? So the Rambam came forward and the Rambam said, I have a great idea. Despite the fact that the Gemara itself and the Rishonim, the early commentaries, say there should be something called Chazarat HaShatz. You want to know what's happening in Egypt? The other religions, the Christians and the Muslims, are looking at us and they're saying, what a bizayon. What a joke. These Jews think they're religious? The Jews care about their God? Have you ever sat in on one of their prayer services? And they're all talking about the stock market the whole time. And they're talking about the Kiddush Club the whole time. And they're yipping and yapping the whole time. That's how they show reverence to their God. So the Rambam says we have a conundrum. On the one hand, we're told that we should have something called Chazarat HaShatz. We should have a repetition of Shemoneh Esrei. On the other hand, we're told that very repetition that was endorsed by the Gemara is creating a massive Chil Hashem. So the Rambam says, I'm going to solve the problem. And the way I'm going to solve the problem is by getting rid of Chazarat HaShatz. There will be no repetition of the Shemoneh Esrei. And what will happen in... I see Dove's liking this already, right? And what will happen in our shul is as follows. Let's say you'll daven Mincha. So you'll say Ashrei. Chazan will finish Ashrei. You'll say Kaddish. The Chazan will start Shemoneh Esrei out loud. And one of 2 things will happen. If you know how to say Shemoneh Esrei, right? If you're wise enough or whatever, you know, learned enough to know Shemoneh Esrei, you'll say it quietly as the Chazan says it out loud. If you don't know how to say Shemoneh Esrei by yourself, you will do what Chazaras HaShatz was intended for, which is you will sit quietly and listen to fulfill your mitzvah through the Chazan. And the Rambam writes, that solved all of our problems. That worked in Egypt for 300 years, until the time of the Radbaz. Because what happened in the time of the Radbaz is you had other people coming from other communities. And they come to Egypt and they find this really strange custom, which is that, right, imagine if you cut down mincha from 12 minutes to 5 minutes. And all of a sudden, people are raising their hands saying, Rabbi, you're not religious. Rabbi, you don't know what you're talking about, right? And they come to the Radbaz and they say, Rabbi Zimri, right, what should we do? On the one hand, this is the custom in Egypt. On the other hand, it's against the Gemara, and it's not the custom from where we're from. What should we do? That is the first tshuva I want to see. Okay? So let's read it. On where it says slide number 9. And again, we're going to read it, just excerpts, on the bottom left-hand side. She'ela, the following question. She'alta mimeni yedid nafshi, one of my beloved friends wrote to me, Amaisa shahaya bishnat, something reish tzadi tet, which is sometime in the 16th century, liyitzira, to the creation of the world, nit'oru kahal asvardim al hakahal hamustarev, right, there was a battle between two different communities, al inyan chazarata tfila b'koran, about whether that we should be saying this out loud, shenagu b'mitzrayim, that this was the custom in Egypt, shaliach tzibur mitpalel tfila achat b'koran, v'ze keneged din ha-gemara v'aposkrim v'sifrei ha-kabbalah. This is against what you see in the Gemara. This is against what you see in the commentaries on the Gemara. And this is very important. This is against what's in the Kabbalah. Why do we care about the Kabbalah? So we'll see that in a subsequent tshuva, but hold that in your mind. Okay? And he goes on to describe the circumstances. If you turn the page, line number 4. Right, I numbered the lines, top right-hand side, to make it a little easier. So line number 4. Tanu kahala mistorev, right, the community in Egypt argued, shezotakanat harambam. This is what's been done since the time of the Rambam. Shekasa b'tshuvas b'lashon arev. The Rambam wrote that in a tshuva. And he describes the problem. You can read it on your own if you'd like. But again, he describes the talking. In line 20, he quotes the son of the Ramban, Rav Avram ben Arambam, who says that this was, we'll just read that quickly, line number 20, right, v'chein he'id alav Rabbi Avram beno, Rav Avram his son wrote, b'sefer shechiber, b'lashon arev, v'zeh tik dvarav kvar noda v'nisparse, that this custom had already spread far and wide. Everyone was following it. So what should we do, Mr. Radbaz? How can we reconcile the custom of the Rambam with what we think is the correct thing to do? Says the Radbaz, bottom left-hand side, where it says tshuva. Did I underline that? Bottom right side, sorry. He writes, Kol ba'alei hadin v'harav hametaken takanazo, even the Rambam, who established this principle, modim ki midina gemara bavlit v'yerushalmit v'hagaonim v'chol haposkin. Everyone agrees. Roi letzibor shid palo shtei tefila achat belachash v'achat b'koram. Everyone agrees that the correct thing to do is say Shtushmon Esrei. V'chei noagin b'chol ha-galilo. This is what they did in all of Galus. Right? And he says this is what has been universally accepted. But he writes the following. What was the Rambam's rationale for starting this custom? That people were talking too much. They were desecrating Shmon Esrei. The Rabbaz comes along and says, you know what? Our community has come a long way. Times have changed. When the Rambam wrote that, there was obviously such a significant need that he had to make the decision that he made. But nowadays, he writes, I think nowadays people can behave themselves. And therefore he says, because the reason the Rambam wrote it is no longer applicable, you know what else shouldn't be applicable? His takana, his decree. And therefore the Radbaz says, even though we've been doing this in Egyptian communities now for 300 plus years, times have changed. The community has changed. The community has evolved. Right? People have come from other places. It's no longer the custom. And so therefore the Radbaz paskins that they should change the custom in Egypt. Now this is significant for a number of reasons. Number one, because remember when I said at the beginning that he is kind of the transition point between the Rambam and later Svardim, takes big muscles, rabbinic muscles, to go against something that the Rambam decreed many generations earlier. Number two is it shows that he clearly felt comfortable arguing with the Egyptian community and telling them, right, you might not like what I'm about to say because you've been so, right, 300 years of doing something is a long time. That's significant custom at this point. For a rabbi to then come along and say, I know you've been doing it for so long, but not anymore. Times have changed and the custom's going to change as well. Okay, that's example number one I wanted to show with you. Example number two. Another major factor in what the Radbaz had to deal with is the issue of the Karaites. Okay? Karaites, of course, were a sect of Judaism that what? They were literalists, right? They didn't believe in Torah Shebaal Peh. They didn't believe in the oral law. They believed that you should read the Torah as it was written. What's the most famous example of that? Tefillin. Tefillin is the most famous example. Where they write, Ve'ayu l'totafot b'neinecha, that the boxes should be in b'neinecha, in between your eyes. So we believe that means that it should be at the hairline, or for many men in the room, where the hairline once was, right? Lined up between the eyes, which is why you'll see men going like this sometimes, just to make sure that their tefillin are lined up. Karaites didn't believe that. They said, no. How do you know that? You know that because of the oral Torah. The written Torah just says it's supposed to be between your eyes. So where should tefillin be? Between your eyes. It should be right here. And that's where they would put their tefillin. So again, that's just one example. Question is now, what do you do with a Karaite who wants to return to Judaism or wants to marry Jewish? What would be the problem? Let's say a Karaite that does tshuva says, I now believe in the oral law, I want to come and I want to marry Sarah Hana Goldberg, right? It's a fake name, right? I want to marry some very religious Jew. What's the problem with that? So he says, I'll change my ways. I believe in the oral Torah now. What's the problem? Divorce. Problem is divorce. Right? Divorce, the whole process of our divorce system is largely built in oral law. Right? The witnesses that we use for divorce. We require a certain level of religiousness to be a qualified witness on a divorce. Now what happens if Joe and Jane are married to one another? They're Karaites. Joe and Jane, things are not going so well. Life's on the rocks a little bit. They decide they're going to get divorced. They go to their Karaite rabbi, and the Karaite rabbi says, rub-a-dub-dub, you're divorced. Here are two witnesses, Gertrude and Chaim, whatever. They're coming. They're going to be your witnesses. You're now divorced. Joe then goes and gets remarried, and they have a child. What's the status of that child? Well, from a Jewish perspective, are Joe and Jane still married? From a religious perspective, a non-Karaite perspective, are Joe and Jane still married? Yes. Joe and Jane are very much still married. So when Joe now has a new child, what's the status of that child? It's a momzer. It's a possible momzer. Jane. So let's do the easier case. So Jane comes along. Jane gets remarried to Chaim Shmuel, and they have a child together, right? So that's now you have a big problem. So that's what the Radbaz in slide number 10 is dealing with. And again, we're just going to read a couple lines because my goal is not to deal with the halacha behind it because I don't want to get bogged down. I just want to show you the types of issues that he is dealing with. Okay? Sheilat mimeni odiacha, again, it's on slide 10, right where I have that arrow. Sheilat mimeni odiacha dati be'echad mi bali mikra. From someone, a bali mikra means someone who just reads the text of the Torah. Shekibel alav divrei chavrut liyot ke'echad me'arabanim v'lishmor kol ha'Torah derabanim. He accepted the mussar of his friends, and he now says, I believe in everything, the whole shebang. Mikol Masha Asru, Im Mutter Lahasio Isho, Im Yesh Bahem Chashash Pisol, Milavo Bekal Olav. Is this guy now allowed to come in and marry Jewish? So if you look on the left-hand side now, where I have the other arrow, okay, so again, it says slide 10 on top, the other arrow. He says it's not going to be a problem. Why isn't it a problem? So he finds a way out. He says the same way their divorces aren't legitimate, you know what else isn't legitimate? Their marriage. All right, when you go to a chuppah, and the rabbi says, the two people here are the witnesses to the exclusion of all others, right? It's because we believe that there need to be valid halachic witnesses to a marriage. If you have two karaim, two non-believing Jews essentially, as the witnesses, says the Rabbaz, it's not a valid wedding. If Joe and Jane were never married, so then anything they did together was simply, right, it was simply znus, I mean, it really wasn't anything, and therefore there isn't a problem with either one of them getting remarried. It means they never needed to get divorced, and there's just been a perpetuation of promiscuity throughout generations, but it solves a heck of a lot of religious problems. I'll show you where this comes in even more prominently, and turn the page to slide number 11. The child's nothing. He's the same way if a non-married man and non-married woman get married, have relations. Yes. So that's what we'll see here. This is, I'd say, in the top three most famous response of the Radbaz. I'd probably even argue this is the most famous response of the Radbaz. Question was the following. There was a group of Jews, the Falushas, who came from northern Africa, black Jews. They argued that they're from the tribe of Dan. They are one of the 10 lost tribes. They now want to come back and be part of the Jewish people. Now, the reason why I say this is probably the most famous tshuva of the Radbaz is because when the whole issue of Ethiopian Jewry exploded in Israel in the 20th century, this Radbaz was really it. It was never dealt with, basically, in halachic literature up until this point. I gave a class on this 2 years ago, Shavuos night. I'm sure you all were there and remember it like it was yesterday, right? But this is really the first major source talking about Jews coming from the 10 lost tribes. As we'll see in a second, the Radbaz considers them Jewish, and it's based on that Rav Avadia Yosef made his very famous psak that the Ethiopian Jews, the Jews from India, right, all of these different tribes of Jews coming to Israel could be considered Jewish. Okay? All based, 100% of Ethiopian Jewry owes their Judaism to slide number 11, to this page of the Radbaz. And the Radbaz was asked the following question. Now I'm going to read the question inside, and we'll do the answer outside. Just because I think the question in many ways is more interesting than the answer. She'ela ma'isa haya bi'isha kushit. A black woman, me'eretz kush, from India. Hanikra al-chavash, shenishbis. She was taken captive. Vishnei banim ima. And she had two children with her. Vikana oso Ruven. Essentially, what is this called? The African slave trade, or more notably, the African. Right, it wasn't just a slave trade. What was it? I mean, it was. What is he buying her for? Right. Let's call it what it is. Right. So, Maaseh, right. So Ruven buys her. Visheilanu espia mativa, and he asks her, like, what's your deal? They're making small talk, you know, what's your name? Ve'amran, she says, Shehaiso, beginning of line 4, Shaita Nesua, that she used to be married, Ve'elu Baneha, these are her children, Mibala Hanikra Shmoploni, she was once married to this guy named John, these are the children from him, Ubenize Shmoploni, and these are my children's name, right, Tom, Dick, and Harry, Uba'u aleim oivim, and what used to happen was, and again, this isn't any different, by the way, than what happens in the Sudan nowadays or other places in the world, right? So enemies would come through the town, the hargu as kol ha'anashim, they would kill all the men, shahayu be'beis ha'kneses, I guess in the shul, ve'as ha'anashim ve'hataf, and what would they do with the women and children? Shavu. They would take them captive. V'nidbarer shehimi zeri Yisrael mishevet Dan. And it became clear in the conversation that she considered herself Jewish from the tribe of Dan. Asher shochnim bahare Kush, that they lived in the mountains of Kush. Umeoso zman arata hayu machzikin osa becheska saguna. And she didn't see her husband be killed. She just assumed that he was killed, so she was Naguna. Ubisoch zman zeh. While they were waiting to clarify what was the status of the husband, Ba aleha Ruvain Adona, so Ruvain has relations with her, Vaholid Memena Ben, they have a child, Vigadal, he grows up, Varehu Rotzela Kacharisha Mikal Yisrael, he now wants to marry a Jew, Vilavo Bahem Vilashela Mimenu Imhu Roy Lavo Bikal Umata Kanto. That's the question, right? That's a doozy of a question, right? The last part is he wants to know if he could be considered Jewish to marry a Jew. Okay? That is a doozy and a loaded question. What was the question? The son.
Because he's the son, because she had relations with another man even though she was married to her first husband and she didn't see him die.
Correct. So now she has a son, and the question is what to do with the son. Now, built into this answer, obviously there's the halachic component of the answer. But what is the fundamental part of the question?
Yeah, she's Naguna or not?
Before whether she's Naguna or not.
Is she Jewish?
If she's not Jewish, then the question ends right then. It's a very short response. If you assume she's Jewish, then you have to bind into a pretzel to figure out a way to get out of it. So the Radbaz writes, maybe we will read a little bit of this inside. Where I'm my second arrow, I spliced obviously a lot. He writes here the following. Where the arrow, the second arrow. V'gdola mizo ani omer, de'afilu lefi dvarea, hi becheskas eishes ish. She's considered married. Sharei advarim mefursam de la'olam yesh melchama bein malchei kush, shalosh ba shalosh malchiot. That he said everyone knows that there were these three kingdoms that used to just do battle back and forth with each other. K'tzaso Yishma'elim, some of them are Arabs. K'tzaso Armim, Hamachazikim, something. K'tzaso Yisraelim, some were Arabs, some were Christians, some were Jews. Mishevet Dan. Ukfianirahim makas mikat Sadok uvaitus hanikraim karaim. These Jews from the tribe of Dan, they were Karites. Right? They were from the people of Tzaduk and Baitus. Who are these Karites? Line 15. Shara'inam Yodim Torah Shabal Peh. They didn't know the oral law. They didn't light Shabbos candles. ... So he starts off with the premise of they're Jewish. Now those four lines that I just read, that's it. The presumption of the Radbaz is the halachic basis for black Jews in Israel. Ethiopian Jews, Indian Jews, tribal, all of those coming from Africa to Israel, the premise upon which we build their Judaism is these four lines of the Radbaz. Now what's fascinating about that, and this is what rabbis have argued, so for example, Moshe Feinstein disagreed with this Radbaz, and he disagreed with it for a good reason. How did the Radbaz know that they were from the tribe of Dan? She said so, right? He didn't have any major, physical proof. Even nowadays, where we have genealogy websites, right? He didn't have any of that. When you were in Egypt, there was no email, there was no Google, right? So he didn't base it on anything, which makes it all the more fascinating that the entire rationale for them being Jewish is built off of these four lines of the Radbaz. The Radbaz's presumption that they're Jewish. How does the Radbaz get out of the halachic issue? Exact same way he did last time. He said, they were never married, they never had to get divorced, and therefore she's fine. But the answer of his question is less important to me than the presumption he makes in answering the question, which is that he presumes they're Jewish. Let's continue. And again, that is the most important tshuva of the Radbaz. Anyone asks, that's the one you're going to quote. The one about the black Jews. Okay? Next one I want to see, and we're running out of time, so we'll probably just do this one inside, and I'll tell you the other ones outside. And this one's slide number 12. Slide number 12 is important for the following reason, and you should remember it as we come to Shavuos this year. I would venture to say BRS is the only show in the country that by June knows what their topic is for next year's Shavuos. So our topic for this coming year's Shavuos is Kabbalah. All of Shavuos is going to be about Kabbalah. One of the classes that will be given is about the role that Kabbalah plays in Halacha. Now why is that significant? That's significant because Rav Yosef Karo, when he's writing the Shulchan Aruch in the 16th century in Tzfat, you know what else is going on in the 16th century Tzfat? There's a lot of Kabbalah learning going on. Well, even before that, you have the Radbaz. The Radbaz, as we mentioned, is a very Kabbalistic writer. He's also a very halachic writer. So what happens when the two of them conflict? So I want to share with you a very practical example of where the Radbaz writes about this. Men in the room, or women who put on tefillin. Men in the room. What do we do on Rosh Chodesh? So we wear our tefillin normally, and then what happens?
Take them off.
Who here has been doing that for much of, since they've been religious? Right? Who here knows why we do that? Because my father did it, because that's what everyone else in Shul does. Because it's Yontif, but Shacharis isn't Yontif. Right. So the answer is, I'm setting you up. The answer is, the reason why we take our tefillin off is because of this tshuva of the Radbaz. Says the Radbaz the following, slide number 12. Okay, where I have the arrow on the bottom right hand side. He says, She'ila sha'alt alma samchu ha'olam lachalot ha'tfilin b'tfilin Musaf Rosh Chodesh. Why is the whole world taking off their tefillin on Rosh Chodesh for Musaf? Teshuvah. The answer. Davar zeh lo nimsa b'gemara. Never mentioned in the Gemara. V'lo b'poskim ha'nimsaim etzleinu. None of the commentaries that we have at our disposal write about it. Where is it written? V'nimtza b'sefer al-kana al-ha-mitzvot. V'alav samchu v'nagu kulam lachlo tzatvila. There's this obscure work called the Sefer al-kana. Anyone ever heard of it? No. There's good reason for that, right? Because we never learn anything from it. But there was this Kabbalistic work called the Sefer al-kana. And in that Kabbalistic work, it talks about removing your tefillin. Ve'afal pi she'enam yodim tamo shel davar. And even though we have no clue why we do it, ela kevan she'ro'u lemiktas ha'mis'askim b'sifrei kabbalah she'chotzen osam gam he'mosim kein. Why do we do it? Because you see these religious, pious Kabbalists sitting in the back corner doing it. So, hey, they must know better than I do. Right? So if they're doing it, they're pretty smart, I should probably do it also. Mitzvah sanada milumada, which basically means people do things by rote. Right? So he says there's no good reason why we're doing this. A couple Kabbalists in the back, by the way, I would venture, if we took a poll of customs in our community, many of them, the reason is, because when I was becoming religious or when I was growing up, I saw someone else doing it and that's why I do it. Right? That's exactly what happens here. It's exactly what happens here.
What is the custom?
Before Musaf, on Rosh Chodesh, men take off their tefillin. So they have it on for a shacharit, and they take it off before Musaf. So the Radbaz writes, I have no clue why people are doing it. So he says the following. Third line up from the bottom, on the right hand side. V'gam ani noeg lachlotz achar sheraiti ha-sefer. He says, even I take my tefillin off after I saw it. V'amadati ha-davar l'fishyesh biyadi klal gadol. He said, this is my principle. This is the principle I live by when it comes to when Kabbalah affects Halacha. Bechol davar shenichta b'gemara. If something's written in the Gemara, o be'echa min ha-poskim, or it's written in a Rishon, for example, o ba'alei halachot, or some Halacha Sefer, afilu she'ya hafach mima she'kasa b'sifrei ha-kabbalah ani modeba. In other words, if there's a conflict between Kabbalah on the one hand and Gemara Halacha on the other hand, what wins out? Gemara and Halacha. What happens when something in Kabbalah does not contradict anything? He says, then I'm happy to go with it. But he says, let me be clear. I'm not doing it because I think it's Halacha. I'm doing it, why? Because what do I have to lose? Right? You hedge your bets. If they're right, great, I did something good. If they're wrong, what's the big deal? So you write, you ask me for my opinion, I'm not going to endorse it because there's really no reason for it. But I'm also not going to lament those who do it because there's no reason not to do it. Okay? Now again, the reason why this is significant, A, I think it's fascinating, just so now we know why we take our tefillin off, at least the men in the room, before Musaf on Rosh Chodesh. But it's a great example of what happens when Kabbalah and Halacha intersect. And in fact, in many cases, contradict each other. This is the Radbaz's principle. And for many subsequent rabbis, this becomes the working model. The working model for how do you employ Kabbalah into Halacha. Rav Yosef Karo, if you learn Shulchan Aruch, oftentimes Rav Yosef Karo will quote Kabbalah in Shulchan Aruch. But again, oftentimes employing these ground rules of the Radbaz. Yeah.
He says,
I don't have a reason. He wrote that. Right? No one knows the reason, but that's the way they do it. These Kabbalists did it. It's quoted in a Sefer. Right? So he didn't know the reason. Okay? Slide number 13, we won't see inside. It's very interesting. I brought it because we discussed earlier how he was the spokesperson to Christianity in many ways. Slide number 13 is the case of a Jew who converts to Christianity and then wants to come back to being Jewish. What process does he have to go through? Does he have to go through a full conversion, partial conversion? That is all slide 13. And the last one I want to see with you is slide 14. And this is concerning a case of a person who studies the Torah and based on his line of reasoning believes that Moshe is Hashem. That Moshe is Hashem. We would associate that, we would call that person what? A heretic, a kofir. Right? So Radbaz was asked, he's a heretic not because he was malicious. Notice he didn't get up and say, I'm going to rebel against God. He studied things in depth, but he had a faulty line of reasoning. In other words, he was misguided, so to speak. But he's not a fundamental heretic. So says the Radbaz, and we'll just read two more lines. If you look on the left-hand side, my second arrow, where it says slide 14, he writes the following. V'lo matzati tam lepotro mina onesh. The whole beginning is why this guy should burn in hell, basically. Right? He says, my only reason to say that this guy shouldn't be punished, zulat mineshu toa biyuno v'takanto v'kil kalato. It's because he made a mistake. In other words, he wasn't malicious. He didn't do it lahachas. He didn't do it to spite anyone. He just was misguided. V'lo adif hai mimasha toed be'echad mi kare adad machmat yuno hanifsad shalo nikra b'shvil ze kofir. It's no different than a guy who, you know, he's learning the Rambam's 13 principles of faith and he makes a mistake. He makes a mistake in his understanding of it. He says, that's not a kofir. He says, Hillel, we know Hillel. So Hillel says, and again, it's a whole different conversation, but Hillel says, Mashiach already came, he came in the time of Chizkiyahu. So says the Radbaz, you know what I call that? That's Kfira. Of course we don't believe Mashiach came. Hillel says that. The answer is Hillel said that because he had a misguided rationale, he had faulty reasoning. No one's going to call Hillel a kofir, so we shouldn't call this guy a kofir either. But again, I show it to you because these are the types of examples, these are the types of cases that were coming to the Radbaz. Issues of heresy, issues of people rejecting the oral Torah, issues of lineage, right? These were the main issues that were coming to the Radbaz. And again, through his responsa, you get a really good sense of some of the examples of where his writing comes in. I'll just conclude with, again, he ends up in Svat, where he dies, in whatever year you want, middle of the 16th century. And just to remind you, there were major things happening in the middle of the 16th century. Which means that not only did he have those students that I showed you earlier, but he really gives birth to a tremendous, tremendous series of rabbis that perpetuate his writings. So if you read any of these or any body of halachic literature, you will more often than not see a tshuva of the Radbaz quoted. If you read something from a Rav Adi Yosef, you will more often than not see a tshuva of the Radbaz quoted. He is really that transition point from the Rambam to the, just this extremely wide-ranging body of responsa. And what makes the responsa so significant is because they were real-life scenarios. They were real-life scenarios, and therefore it was easy for later-day rabbis to use him as their halachic basis. So hopefully through this class you learned a little bit about the Radbaz. Next week we have with Rabbi Goldberg on the Chida.